Sometimes in life, you have to find out what you don't want to do before you figure out what you do want to do. And that's definitely part of our guest story this month on Write You a Song. Welcome in. Write You a Song is a production of Bonneville Communications International and produced at the studios of KNCI Radio in Sacramento, California. I'm Tom Maley. Follow me on Twitter at KNCI Tom for podcast updates. And if you like the podcast, take a moment and give it a review. Share it, too, with anyone you know who thinks songwriters are like the most underappreciated people in music. And yeah, it took an appearance on NBC's The Voice for this month's guest, Nicole Galyon, to realize that she didn't really like being on stage, which helped her realize that her creative focus should be locked in solely on songwriting. And it was the right choice. Just 2 years after her Voice appearance, she won a CMA for Miranda Lambert's Automatic. And in 2015, she won an ACM for Miranda and Keith Urban's We Were Us. She's had several number ones and over a dozen other hits, including...
Girl, you're so smooth. So smooth.
And some of us get stuck in a love triangle.
Female.
Pretty good for a girl from a small town in Kansas who never thought songwriting would be her path until that 2012 season of The Voice when she was picked to be part of Adam Levine's team. Let's get her story right now on Write You a Song. Nicole Galyon, thank you for joining us today on Write You a Song. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
And you are, I think, the second or third songwriter that I've had on here that really didn't grow up thinking they wanted to be a songwriter necessarily. And another one of those people happens to be your husband, Rodney Clausen. Coincidence?
You know, I just think, I don't know if it's a coincidence. I could probably come up with a reason that sounded like it made sense in hindsight, maybe why we have that in common. But I just don't think that we knew. I don't think either of us knew that that was a thing that was possible. I don't think we realized that that was a job.
It is just so interesting that you two found each other. And like Rodney, when he was on, he was talking about how he just had a friend who was in Nashville who realized being around songwriters that he talked like them and that he might make a good songwriter. And then how did you realize that you might have an ability to write songs?
Well, when I went to Belmont, I went to Belmont, and that's what got me to Nashville in 2002. And I started giving some piano lessons as just a way to pay the bills my freshman year of college. And through that job, I ended up giving some piano lessons for some kids of parents who worked in the music business. And they knew that I wanted to be in the music business in some capacity. So I started getting invited to some parties, like events at people's houses. They're like, hey, come network, come meet some people. And it's pretty common in Nashville, as you know, for people to start passing a guitar around in the living room and people would play songs that they had written. And the very first time that I ever saw what they call in Nashville a guitar pull, which is a fancy way for saying people playing songs they wrote,
right. I
just thought to myself, I think I can do that. And I really thought to myself, I have to try that. And it wasn't because I thought I'd be good at it. I was such a writer growing up, not a songwriter, but I had written in any opportunity I had to write. Even, you know, in the summers, I would write the copy for our hometown newspaper. That was one of my summer jobs. So I loved words. And so then when I found out that was such a big part of Nashville, once I got there, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to do this.
So
but it took a long time for me to really own that and say that was what I wanted to do for my job or for a living. I just was so curious to try to go write songs.
Right, because when you originally went to Nashville, you thought you wanted to do artist management, and then you saw these people doing a guitar pull. And did it just look fun to you? Was that like the beginning and end of it? If it just looked like something fun to try?
Fun, and also I think I just knew myself and knew that I could write. And that sounds kind of arrogant, but it really wasn't arrogant. It was more just knowing myself and knowing that I was I always excelled in any chance I got to write, whether it was creative writing or poetry or essays, or I was the yearbook editor, like anything that I could write, literary journal I was in charge of in high school. So like, I just knew, well, oh, I want to write that. I want to write something like that. And so I think that's kind of how I knew that I had to go do it.
Were you a country music fan growing up?
Yes. So that it was really a perfect storm because I was a super fan of country music. I grew up writing, like I was that kid that if a teacher said, write three sentences about the circus, I would write three pages. Like I was just, I couldn't stop writing. And then I also grew up playing classical piano very seriously. I did competitions. I did concerto competitions and all of that stuff on the classical side. So once I got that itch to try to write, I had the instrumental foundation to be, you know, to go sit in the room by myself and, you know, accompany myself and come up with chords and all of that.
Do you remember the first song that you actually wrote?
Let me think. Yes, it was called Naive, which is ironic because I was.
And did you feel like after you finished it that it was like as good as anything that you were hearing on the radio, or did you realize that,
no,
okay, I need to work on things a little bit?
No, I actually, I was so fast and furious about wanting to write. I wrote four songs in, I think, a weekend by myself in the practice rooms at Belmont. And one was called Naive. One was called So Cruel or Cruel, I think. And then I forget what they were all called, but there was one song and they were all horrible. I mean, now they're all trash and it didn't take me very long to get, like, you know, in the beginning you seem to get better pretty quickly because you have nowhere else to go but up from the first few songs that you write. But in that first batch of four songs, there was one song that seemed to kind of like resonate with people. And it was a song that I had written about my dad building our house. My dad was a builder and a construction worker growing up. And so he built this house that I grew up in. And it was just called The House That Dad Built. And not to be confused with the greatest song of all time, The House That Built Me,
right?
Which is the way it should have been written. But I remember when I played all those four songs for people, that was the one that resonated. And I learned quickly that the reason that one worked was because it was real. It wasn't really just about my feelings. It was about people. It was about my real story. It was about life. And it was very, and I think even if I don't even have a copy of that song, someone does somewhere on a CD, but it's long been lost in hard drives. But I would dare to say that if I went and played that, if you heard that song today, it would make sense that it was the same writer that maybe like wrote some of the songs that ended up being successful for me, because I think that was like the very first little insight to, oh, this is what you actually do well.
Right. So and it sounds so, like yeah. that song you recognized was something.
Yes, it made someone feel something. Mm-hmm. It still wasn't a great song, but I felt like it did what a song should. It was starting to do in a very, very elementary way, do what a song should do, which is hold your attention, make you feel something, make you think about your life, all of those things.
Yeah. You have a quote that is really similar to your husband's, another parallel you guys have. Gee, I wonder how you ended up together.
Stole it from him, so that's why.
Well, he puts it a little more tersely. Yours is, you had to be bad at songwriting for a very long time. And anybody coming to Nashville and starting out as a songwriter, they should just anticipate that they're going to have to be bad for a long time. Your husband puts it differently, dare to suck. Just... But basically saying the same thing. You're going to have to go through and just be trashy before you start finding little nuggets that are worth something.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think to that point, one thing that I talk about a lot with younger writers that ask, like when I speak at Belmont or a school or something about writing, I say, you know, if you are truly from in my opinion, if you truly are a songwriter and that's what you're meant to do, you're going to have good taste when it comes to music. You're going to have a good taste of like what a good song is. The things you like to listen to are probably good songs. And there's going to be, and whatever that bar is for your taste, there's going to be a long time, likely years and years, where you aren't like the songs that you write don't live up to your taste. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be dissatisfied, and you have to for a while with the songs you write, because you know, if you are intrinsically, if you are meant to be a songwriter, you know what a good song is. Mm-hmm. And you also will know, I'm not writing good enough songs yet for a long time. And I think that really separates the ones that have the grit to be able to make it, and the ones that don't, because it's a really uncomfortable space to be, to sit in that space for several years of going, I just keep making things that I know that aren't good enough for my taste yet.
Right, right.
You don't know what's missing yet. You just have to keep writing to write through that period.
But it's interesting because you are also learning to rely on yourself and your gut.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, 100%. And your gut can also tell you that's not good enough. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it is listening to yourself and saying, just because it's not good enough yet doesn't mean that it won't be. And it doesn't mean that you won't have a career doing it. It just means you have to keep working and honing your craft. I mean, we're not talking about like making a paper airplane here. Like, we're talking about something that very few people in the world statistically end up making a living doing. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's like a little niche, you know, career, and there's just not a lot of artists, and there aren't a lot of spots on records, and it's highly competitive. And if you really, really, really want to fulfill that dream of getting one of those cuts, you're going to have to just like buckle up and just get really, really, really good.
What was the first song that you wrote where you thought this could be recorded by somebody, and did it get recorded by somebody?
So I wrote a song probably, which by the way, like in the first probably 3 to 4, probably the first 3 years that I was a songwriter, I only wrote by myself. And I wrote a song called Right About Now, about a year in, maybe it wasn't a year, maybe it was about 6 months into writing songs. And I wrote it around my birthday, like the first birthday that I was not living at home in Kansas. And I was away in Nashville, and it was just like the song that was about right about now, the corn's about 6 feet high, right about now, like I'd give anything to be in my hometown.
Gotcha.
Actually at the time, because of an assistant job that I had had, I had become pretty good friends with John Rich, who was, you know, this was like right as Big and Rich was getting their record deal, Gretchen was getting her record deal, and John, I worked for John's agent. And so he had heard some of these songs that I was writing, and he actually offered to do a single song publishing deal agreement with me on that one song. He's like, he wanted to do it basically just a one song deal to try to get that song cut for me. And ultimately I didn't do that deal because at the time it was the best song that I had. And I still am glad that I didn't do that deal. Not because of John or anything, but because I just wanted to bet on getting a full publishing deal,
right,
an exclusive deal down the road. And it was a few years later that I eventually got that. But the fact that he offered me that deal let me know that that song was worthy of being cut. Should the stars align and all the luck and all of the things, the other things that have to go into it. But that was the first time that I thought, in terms of song quality, that I had made something that could actually be on a record.
What's interesting about you, too, is that in 2012, you were on The Voice and you were on Adam Levine's team. And you said afterwards, after you were off the show, that that appearance, because you have a marvelous voice, you're a great singer, and
thank you.
But you said you realize that show made you realize that you'd rather be a songwriter than a performer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never grew up with aspirations of being on stage. I was always on stage over to the side as the accompanist for the girls that were singing. That was something that I did a lot in church, like the girls who were vocalists, you know, singing hymns. Like I would practice with them and I would play for them. So I was used to being on stage. Like I was kind of in the orbit of performance, but I wasn't out front and center, and I never wanted to be. You know, and my goal in Nashville, what I knew at my core was that I was a creator, that I was a writer. But then 5-6 years into my publishing deal, nobody was cutting my songs. And, it's that definition of insanity, just keep doing the same thing, hoping for a different result. And right. So I was like, well, maybe I need to open my mind a little bit. I'm young enough. I can play piano. I can sing. Okay. I can, I think I have a bit of a creative edge. So I had kind of convinced myself to consider trying to, I was like, if nobody else is going to record my songs, maybe I need to just go record them. And that's how my songs are going to get heard. But my motivation for trying to be an artist was never because I wanted to perform. It was because I just wanted my songs heard. And so that I got into that mindset. And then through that, I kind of put together a band and was trying to teach myself how to perform at these little dive bars in Nashville. And through word of mouth, I had gotten recommended to try out for The Voice. And that's kind of how I ended up on the show. But it wasn't because I was banging down the doors. I hadn't trying to be an artist. I had never even taken a meeting with a label, I don't think, at that point. But going and doing The Voice, I have said, is like the butterfly effect for me, because if you take The Voice out of my story, I don't know that I would be here today, because it really gave me clarity and affirmed that I really was a songwriter. I had a bit of an epiphany through the process, which I loved doing The Voice. It was the scariest thing I've ever done, and I think that's probably why I loved it, because I use my fear as a compass, and it's like the things that scare me are usually what I'm like, well, I should probably go do it then.
Every now and then I get a little lost. My strings all get tangled, the wires all get crossed, and I just thank God you're here. 'Cause when I'm a bullet shot out of a gun, and when I'm a firecracker coming undone, and when I'm a fugitive ready to run, all I crave, and I know I don't tell you nearly enough, but I could not live one day without your love. 'Cause when I'm a bullet shot out of a gun, and when I'm a firecracker coming undone, and when I'm a fugitive ready to run, all wild-eyed and crazy, baby, you save me.
Oh my God! But when I got back from The Voice, I had this epiphany of, it wasn't that I wasn't going to do music. It was, oh, you're a creator, not a performer. Because there were a lot of things about being on that show that I learned that were soul-sucking. Like, I don't want someone to ever tell me to just sing a song for the sake of singing a song. I don't get any pleasure out of singing songs in front of people, period, let alone, not my own. So that was, something I learned. And I think that it taught me just to be brave. So when I came back to Nashville, I was like, if I can do that, I can do anything. Like the simple act of writing a song and going on Music Row, I was like, I just felt like I belonged on Music Row more than ever. And I still, it's been almost 10 years now. That was 2012. I still can't quite articulate it in one sentence why The Voice was what it was for me, but it was pivotal for sure.
No, it absolutely, you can just hearing that story, you can see sort of the artist that you've become develop. And you also made some really important connections, too. You met Ray Lynn and helped work with her on her debut album. And you also met Miranda Lambert, who you've written a few pretty good songs with over the last several years.
Yeah, that is the other piece of the butterfly effect was was that if not for the voice, I don't know if my first few hits would have happened, because, you know, Automatic was my second number one with Miranda, and obviously there's the tie-in there with Miranda to the voice. But I'm pretty sure that the day we wrote Automatic, Miranda asked me, I think being with her, and that was the very first time we had written, was the day we wrote Automatic, and I think being with her had jogged her memory, and she was like, I need to check back in with Keith on that song that I sang on of yours, because she had sung on We Were Us, mm-hmm. but no one had gotten word if it was actually ever going to be on the record or anything. And so, you know, just something little like that could have made all the difference of her going, you know what, I'm going to call Keith and ask him what's going on with that song.
Review crosses, railroad ties, oh, Hail Marys, Friday nights, heartbeat baby, low beam lights. God, I miss when you were mine back when. That song, the song I could sing along without thinking about you every time I came home. Every beat, every line, every word, every time when the road was a road I could run on through without wishing that empty seat was you. Money was gas, dreams were dust, love was fast and we was.
Mm-hmm. Those two songs ended up being my first two hits. So it's, you know, who's to say?
And the other thing,
what would have happened,
even though all of that had happened and you were working with Ray Lynn and you had kind of some inside connections. And of course your husband was a writer at that time. You were saying that when you sat down to write Automatic with Miranda, you had a brand new baby and you were right at a point in your life where you were starting to think, you know what, maybe I should go be a mom.
Yes. I'm a pretty spiritual person, and I had really strong feelings when I was pregnant that if I could get pregnant and have a baby, that I was going to give all of my energy to that for a while. And at that point, I had not had a song on the radio yet. So I was very realistic about what that looked like if I stepped back and took some time off from writing to be a full-time mom. I knew the reality was that I was taking myself out of the game on some level. And I also, on a spiritual level, felt like, you know what, God, if you hand me this baby and everything in my being says that I don't ever want to go to work again, I'm going to give myself permission to do that, because I've given this town at that point almost 10 years. And well, right at 10 years, actually. And I felt like I had reconcile the idea of like having peace with walking away, because I knew that I had really worked as hard as I could. I didn't have any regrets. And I had committed to take 3 months off of writing to stay home from maternity leave. And 3 weeks in, I got the phone call to write with Miranda for the first time. And I didn't have that feeling when I became a mom that I was for sure supposed to stay home full time. It just wasn't like that wasn't genuine for me. I thought I was open to that, to feeling that way, but I didn't. I was like, oh, I think I'm still a songwriter, maybe. And then when I got that opportunity to write with Miranda, and everything just started like snowballing, like immediately, like my career just, I felt like it just like shot off like a rocket. And I was like, really? Right now? Okay. But it really was like everything changed for me. It felt like overnight when We Were Us came out, and I was like, okay, now I didn't really know how to be a successful songwriter without being a mom, because it happened at the same time. And so I never really, so that was kind of a gift, because I had some built-in boundaries. I didn't get ahead of, like, I didn't like get too far ahead of myself, because I was just in such a like grounding season of life. When you have a newborn or just a kid in general, you're just so grounded that as some of these songs started popping off and good things were happening, it was a really cool balance of, you know, nursing a baby and also trying to like have my head in the clouds at the same time.
Quarter in a payphone, drying laundry on the line, watching some tea in the window, pocket watch, a tail in time. Seems like only yesterday I'd get a blank cassette, record the country countdown, cause I couldn't buy it. We drove all the way to Dallas just to buy an Easter dress. We'd take along a Rand McNally, stand in line to pay for gas. God knows that shifting gears ain't what it used to be. I learned to drive that 55 just like a queen, three on a tree. Hey, whatever happened to
playing writers in Nashville? In fact, I just, the podcast previous to this one, I talked to James Slater and we talked a little bit about composing on piano and how there used to be, it seems like, more people who wrote on piano in Nashville. And now, gosh, in the last 20 years, I could think of like maybe Phil Vassar, Mr. Slater, yourself. Is that an accurate read?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely the minority. But you know who is a piano player first in the room for the most part is Ashley Gorley. And a lot of people don't know that.
Ah.
He is, you know, arguably the most successful songwriter of our generation. And he plays piano. And in fact, when I very first started taking publishing meetings and I was playing people piano vocals of just me singing with my little keyboard, you know, in my bedroom, those little recordings, they were like, these kind of remind us of when, like, young Ashley Gorley, which, wow, like, I even, like, shudder at the thought of comparing myself to him, because he is the Ashley Gorley, but he is another piano player. I think it gives you some different melodic skills, and I have a pretty thorough understanding of theory that I think, like, some people that just come to Nashville and only know, like, the Nashville number system might know, you know, which that's really all you do need to know. But it is nice to be able to like use some terms in the studio occasionally with someone, you know, like to understand like how to read music and all that feels kind of like a little secret superpower sometimes. Because I have to say this, I rarely write on piano anymore. But I play when I go play at the Bluebird or play a show, you know, like a listening room or a writer's round. I sit down at the piano and learn them on the piano now, because I'm mainly writing with producers.
Right. And when you say you're not writing with piano, you're writing with tracks that have already been created. How does that help? Or, I don't know, it probably doesn't hinder because you've written some huge hits that way, but how is it different as a composer?
Well, for me personally, I think that, you know, I guess it started about 10 years ago, was really like when the track guy, you know, became a big thing in our writing world. And I joke that I don't know that I would have had success before the track guy revolution, because I learned that I was a better writer in the room when I wasn't playing piano anymore.
Why?
The very first, I think that there's usually more chords to go around than there are words in lyrics in a room, from what I have found. There aren't as many, I don't think, and I could be wrong, but what I've found is that there are less top liners, less idea, concept, lyric people to go around than there are people that play chords and have melody and make tracks.
I've heard that from other writers on the podcast. Amy Mayo has said that. Liz Rose has talked about that and how having writing skills, because neither one of both of them admit they don't play music, but being able to write, being able to get those lyrics out is hugely valuable when you're in that room in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that Nashville has the best players in the world, and that runs the gamut from studio musicians down to songwriters. I mean, I can throw a rock in any direction and hit someone that is a great guitar player that can come up with a great progression or a really cool musical hook. But it's a lot harder for me, at least, to find another top liner to write with. And, you know, it's funny to even think that I was known as a piano player first, because that's really how that was my entry into music. But I truly think that I contribute the most to a song when I am idea and lyric first and not having to think about the chords and the music piece.
Right. Another thing that that you said that I think is important for maybe young aspiring songwriters who might be listening today is you and your husband call yourselves lunch pail songwriters, and it is a it's a 9-to-5 job. And one of the things that you said is you can't wait for inspiration. It's not that romantic image of, you know, being inspired by, you know, a windy day on a bluff over the ocean or something like that. You've got to grind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some, you know, in all the years now that I've written, I've seen a lot of really more days, actually, where we've written our way into a moment of inspiration, as opposed to being inspired and then writing. And honestly, like, experientially, is that a word? Experientially, like, that's...
Works for me.
That's, from an experience standpoint... At the end of my life, those are the moments that are magic to me as a songwriter, is when I'm like, what just happened? How did that happen? You know, like, how did we just like stumble? Someone accidentally mumbled something that sounded like three other words, and it ended up being an idea. And then the song just fell out in 20 minutes and now it's on the radio. Like, those kind of situations, those situations are more likely to happen if you show up every day and make yourself available.
Can you give me an example of one of those songs that just kind of, you don't know where it came from, but it just, boom, there it was?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, for me, most of the good ones are Boy, which is probably one of my top three most sacred creations in my life, for me personally. Was that way. I was writing with John Knight, who I don't know if you've had him on here, but he's a great one if you ever want to have him on here. But he and I we went way back, and we struggled together for a lot of years in the beginning. And we were writing right before I had my son. It was my last day on the books before I was going to have my second child, our son. And I threw out a bunch of ideas, you know, like prepared ideas, and nothing was really sticking. And it was just the two of us. And we wrote We Were Us together. It was like our first number one hit together. And so we got tattoos, and like, we're like brother and sister close. And so it was just really comfortable that day. Again, when you're really close with someone and you have that rapport, I think you're also more likely for some magic to happen, because there's like an intimacy, you know, to it. But we were just talking, and we just kept, he was really, nothing was really sticking. And he just said something like, let's just write a song to your boy. Like, you're about to have a boy. Let's write a song to your boy. He's like, I've got it, you know. And we wrote that song almost like a diary entry. Like, first word to last word, chronological order, chronologically, like, which is not typically how songs are written. Usually, like, scan out the song and have the hook and kind of do like an architect. You kind of architect the song out, and then you go back and write the lyrics, because you need to know what the idea is and how you're going to organize the song.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just a stream of consciousness, like tears coming out my eyes, very hormonal. and didn't even really mean to make it all land the way that it did, like to have boy land at the end of the chorus the way that it does. Like, mm-hmm. you're always going to be a boy. Like, I never planned on that. I was just trying to write a song that I would, like a little lullaby that I, something I wanted to say to him. And I think, you know, that was when, and then we walked out of the room and we were like, wow, I think that's, I don't think that that's just special to us. I think that's a really good song.
Boy, you're gonna know it all. You'll think you're 10 feet tall. Run like you're bulletproof and total a car or two. Boy, you're gonna hate this town. Wish you could burn it down. That fire in your eyes is 20 counties wide. But boy, you're gonna love 17. And boy, you'll do some stupid things. You're gonna drive and kiss and throw a punch and grow up way too fast. You're gonna drop the ball, hit the wall, and break some hearts like glass. I know you will, 'cause you're a part of me and a part of you, who will always be a boy. You're gonna be so stubborn. You get that from your mother. I already see it now. You weren't built for backing down. Boy, there'll be a small town night.
And we both said, like, man, you know who would be our number one to sing this? I would love to hear Lee Bryce's voice on this. And it was a couple years later that it finally came out, but it ended up being Lee Bryce. And what's crazy about that song is that, you know, I was still pregnant. I had not seen my son's face. I didn't know his personality or anything about him. And everything about that song, I swear I manifested my son. I mean, everything about it, that song is like, has come true. Wow. So yeah, it was pretty wild, pretty wicked to like look like when he's like 2-3 years old and it's on the radio and he's in the back seat in the car seat singing it and going like, wow, we wrote this before you, like before we saw your face, and now it just completely resonates. So that was one.
I do have a question about a song that maybe isn't as well known. And to me, it speaks to your versatility as a writer, because you can write very traditional country music, and you also write very cutting edge, contemporary, almost borderline sort of rap R&B country songs, like Walker Hayes, Halloween.
I love that song.
There is a line in there that blew me away. I love you for being somebody I'm not ashamed to introduce my skeletons to. That is an unbelievably cool line.
Oh, thank you. Gosh, that's one of those that just feels, you know, there's a lot of different ways you get rewarded as a songwriter, right? You know, like some of it pays your bills. Some of it's you get to hear, it could be like hear a stadium sing your words back. But some songs are rewarding just in the fact that you get to have that song in your life for the rest of your life. And I think that that song is just something, a song that like, I'm just so proud to have my name on it. And Walker is, I give Walker all the credit on that song, because the way his brain works is like no other writer I've ever worked with. And I think he's one of the like most underrated gems in our writing community. He has such a quirky style, but the way that he concepts songs is so sophisticated and complex and advanced. And honestly, it goes over some people's heads because we're just not used to certain things being that good. And I may have come up with that line, he may have come up with that line, but he had laid the groundwork for the concept so much that we couldn't have failed.
Before I even learned to play a note, I was on stage, mastering the art of selling myself at a young age. Fear and insecurity drove me like a Maserati. High school was like showing up at a costume party. I was a comedian, an athlete, a golden boy, a black sheep, whatever I had to be to make the world throw candy at me. And college was the same act, different play.
It was October 31st every day, and the real world was an all too familiar street. Another trip, another tree. Then I knock, knock, knocked on your door. Every mask I ever wore shattered like glass on the floor. And it was like
Halloween ended.
But what would it change if I knew? Maybe my parents messed up, but hey, they're just dressed up kids too. Maybe I guess what I'm trying to say is I love you for being somebody I'm not ashamed to introduce my skeletons to. I still put on my Superman cape and hide in it, but when I'm with you, it comes untied for a minute. Hits the ground in the shadow of your skin.
Knowing his story, the song is just, it's really personal. Is it tough sometimes to write with somebody who's trying to almost be cathartic on their end?
I mean, it can be sometimes. I think sometimes I wrestle with, you know, do you do what's best for the song or do you do what's best for the human? Because sometimes, you know, sometimes it is cathartic. It's therapeutic for an artist. It's important for them to feel that if they got married in June, that's what the song says. But if you need to rhyme with February would be what rhymed. And it made it all like phonetically roll off the tongue better. And it matched the phrasing. Like there's that moment where you're really wrestling. You're like, oh, but it would sound so much better if you said that. So I think it just depends on the person. But I think with someone like Walker specifically, since we're talking about him, I do think that I would err on the side of what is most personal for him, because that is such a big piece of his style. He doesn't sing about things vaguely. He sings about things in a very detailed way, and that's what makes him special. So I think making something vague for him feels like it's not him anymore. But other artists, you can argue that it's not going to make a difference whether you say red truck or blue truck. That's not what makes that artist.
Right, right. With the time that we have left, I'm going to throw out the names of some of the songs that you've talked about a lot in your career, but I want to get just your brief kind of thoughts on each one of them and how they came to be. We've got three or four top bill songs here.
Okay.
And I'm going to start with one. Maybe you don't get hit with as much, but I thought it was one of the most powerfully written and well sung country songs of the last few years, and that's Homecoming Queen.
Oh, thank you for saying that, because goodness, I love that song. I'm so proud of that one. You know, when we wrote that song, I knew that it meant so much to us as writers. And that was one that just fell out. It fell out on a bus in the middle of somewhere in the Midwest, out on the road with Kelsey. And I got to be honest, like, I don't want to make it about me because this is Kelsey's song. But this song was something that really resonated with me personally, too. I was the homecoming queen in my high school. At a younger age, I did struggle with trying to, you know, be too performance driven and not as vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've grown a lot as I've gotten older to where I am a more vulnerable, softer version of myself and I'm not afraid to show my imperfections. And so I am just so proud that song's out there. And I think, you know, it sounds cheesy, but as a mom, it's like, that's the stuff that I want my daughter to be able to listen to on country radio too. I love it all. I love the party songs out in the country, and I get the biggest kick writing those songs too. But man, I was disappointed that country radio didn't make that a bigger hit than what it was. But I think that it made an impact on a human level just the same way, whether it went to on the charts or number one. I don't think anyone outside of Nashville didn't feel like it was an impactful song.
Hey, homecoming queen, why do you lie when somebody's mean? Where do you hide? Do people assume you're always all right? Been so good at smiling most of your life. Look damn good in the dress, zipping up the mess. dancing with your best foot forward. Does it get hard to have to play the part? Nobody's feeling sorry for you. But what if I told you the world wouldn't end if you started showing what's under your skin? What if you let them all in on the light? Even the homecoming queen cries.
I think songs like that are songs like that in the world. Like you said, I love a good party anthem. I've said that before on this podcast, but I also love songs. And when I was a kid, music was how I figured out life, you know? And there were, you know, songs that were written where I'd go, I recognize myself or I recognize my predicament. And all of a sudden, you know, it's a cliche, but I wasn't alone in the world anymore. And, you know, if that artist was able to get through it, I can too. And to me, Homecoming Queen is that type of a song.
Well, thank you. And I love to hear that. I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but I love to hear that from a man too, because I thought that that was such a, you know, feminine slanted song that I'm glad that it to know that it transcended just females, because the concept isn't based on a gender or anything, but it's more just about human nature. And, I love that song so much. That song went platinum. You know, and it's something that people don't really talk about. People don't realize that, like, sometimes a song will go number one, but it won't sell. And then sometimes a song won't go number one, and it will really sell.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've had that experience enough now with other songs. For instance, like God Made Girls went gold and wasn't on the radio that much. Love Triangle did well, like, in terms of sales and So I think I've opened my mind to having different kinds of goals for my songs than just being a number one on radio.
Well, and that you just, I'm sorry to go down a side path, but does digital music being available digitally, does that help that out? Like Homecoming Queen didn't get the airplay that maybe it should have, but any young person, any person who identified with that song, who loved it, can immediately go to, you know, a platform and buy it for 99 cents or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think we get to see some more real. One great thing about like the DSPs, the digital services, is that, or the platforms, is that those are real numbers. Like someone is really clicking on that. Like you can't, you know, like, and you can really, you get to see like the longevity of a song. Years later, people are still coming back and listening to certain songs. And I am a radio junkie. Like country radio is the reason why I have a relationship with country music. I grew up out in the middle of nowhere in Kansas. We barely had CMT, you know, like we barely had cable and country radio was like what got me to Nashville. And I still listen, even with all the different platforms, when we're living in Kansas right now. I don't know if Rodney shared that with you on his podcast, but I drive around and listen to FM radio like it's still my number one, you know, because there really is nothing like hearing your song on the radio. But there is a different trajectory for songs now and a different kind of way to see, like, what do people really want to listen to 3 years later?
Right.
You know, and you can see that on some of the DSPs. Not to go down into the weeds of music business talk, but
no, but it's important that, especially again, if you're a young singer songwriter listening to this, that's stuff you need to know. All right, we're going to swing the pendulum completely opposite direction. All the Pretty Girls.
That was one of those, just like, to be honest, like just another day at work kind of days. I don't remember there being anything that felt. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but I didn't feel like there was anything magical about that day. I felt like I loved the song, but we wrote that song on piano with Tommy Lee James and Josh Osborne. So we wrote it on piano and it was cool. It felt a lot like Small Town Saturday Night, the old Hal Ketchum song, when we were writing it. And, you know, and it was whatever day it was, you know, we write every day. So like we wake up the next day, go write another song and another song. And by the time that song got demoed a few weeks later, I'd probably written 10 more songs. And then it went on hold and Kenny cut it immediately. So it was just kind of like, it was a little bit like out of my mind. I wasn't quite, you know, some songs you get really invested in their journey because the journey is a long time. Like say someone puts a song on, you know, Blake Shelton or Morgan Wallen or somebody puts one of your songs on hold. It could be on hold for 6 months, a year, and you're just waiting for them to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're waiting to see the track list. And that song got cut right as he was finishing up his album. And when I got to hear the cut, because we wrote it on piano, when it sounded like a rock song, and I was like, it was so fabulous to get to hear it. It felt like I was hearing it for the first time.
All the pretty girls said, pick me up at 8. All the pretty girls said, I'm going to L.A. All the pretty girls said, I hate my hair. Talking to the mirror. Said I just got paid. All the lost boys said I wanna get laid. When the town goes blue and the lights blink red, all the lost boys do what all the pretty girls say. I'm home for the summer, shoot out the lights. Don't blow my cover, or I'm free tonight. I'm coming over, call all your friends. Somebody hold me, all the pretty girls said. Whiskey went to my head. Shut up and kiss me, all the pretty girls said.
Oh, and also, like, Kenny's one of those people that, you know, he's one of those that I was a true fan of. I went to Fanfare when I was 14 and got his autograph, and it was almost 20 years. It was the 20 year of me going to Nashville for the first time with my mom and going to Fanfare when he put that song out. And
wow.
I was like, wow, like really what a testament to his career, because who gets to have a relevant career that long? Not very many people. And to get to have a cut by someone that you grew up a true fan of and like waiting in line to get their autograph, it just hits different. I mean, I love, you know, like I love writing with all these new artists, and that's fulfilling in its own way, but to have, you know, to have a cut by somebody that you grew up a real fan of is something. And the last remaining one that I have that I really, really want, I really, really want a Tim McGraw cut. I've never had a McGraw cut, and he is one of those, you know, for me, it was Kenny, Keith, and Tim. But I need Tim, and I just keep striking out on every record. So Tim, if you're out there, please listen to my songs.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a pretty good resume.
Please give me a chance.
All right, last song. Just I love from the first time I heard it, just the take on your Dan and Shay smash Tequila. Where did that idea come from? Was that another day in the songwriting room, or did you know that song was going to be special?
Okay, unique things about that day. One, we were supposed to be writing with Shay, Dan and Shay, and Shay had to cancel for a family something, a doctor's appointment or something. And so I think we almost didn't write because we were like, should we still write? You know, and we showed up anyway, which is a testament to show up. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea came from Jordan Reynolds, and he had been to a whiskey tasting or something, or tequila tasting a few days before, and had overheard a buddy of his say like, well, when I taste tequila, I think da da da, or I feel this, or I, you know, it tastes like this or whatever. And he just wrote down the title, When I Taste Tequila, and brought that in and threw that out to us. And the original working title was When I Taste Tequila. And it was right before the single came out, or not too long before that, well, they had recorded it, and we found out it was going to be a single, and Dan texted us and said, you know, I think we're just going to call it Tequila. And I was like, that is way cooler. Thank you so much.
I can still shut down the party. I can hang with anybody. I can drink whiskey and red wine, champagne all night. Little scotch on the rocks and I'm fine.
taste tequila. Baby, I still see ya cutting up the floor in a sorority t-shirt, the same one you wore when we were sky high in Colorado. Your lips pressed against the bottle, slamming on a Bible, baby, I'd never leave you. I remember how bad I need you when I taste tequila.
Nicole, thank you so much for taking time. You've given me more time than I expected or deserve, and it's been fun to talk to you.
Well, you know what? I love anybody that loves a songwriter, so thank you for having me.
Awesome.
Thank you.
I can show up to the same bar, hear the same songs in my car. Maybe your memory, it only hits me this hard.
And that will do it for this month's episode of Write You a Song. Again, if you like it, give it a review and share it. And follow me at KNCI Tom on Twitter for podcast updates. Big thanks again to Nicole Galyon for joining me. And next month, a songwriter who's finally stepping out as a performer, too. And his personal style of country is entirely different than what he writes for others.
I got everything I need and nothing that I don't. Oh, no. Ever since you moved. We just trying to catch a good time, even if it takes all night.
Hear why Nico Moon thinks what he's doing isn't just country, it's essential to country music's growth. Next month on Write You a Song.
Picking on them guitars just right. Everybody singing Dixieland alike, like a barber on a wet line. We just trying to catch a good time. Way down here we all got that southern drawl. We take our time when we talk, hey y'all. Yeah, don't take much.